You know what you're listening to?
Is that a trick question?
It's the I Still Love This Game podcast with your host, Matthew Damien.
He's an idiot. Don't listen to he's an idiot.
Hello and welcome to episode 49 of the I Still Love This Game podcast. We're up to day 11 of the NBA playoffs, and with that, we're heading towards the tail end of the first round playoff series. So we had three massive games today, and we're going to start with Boston and Milwaukee. And with the series tied at two games apiece, you could expect a very close game. And early on, that's exactly what we got. Boston seemed intent on not letting Giannis get comfortable in the offense. The Bucks, on the other hand, were riding a wave of confidence after games 3 and 4, which of course they won to level the series up. What we could have been excused for was underestimating the impact that Marcus Smart had. Now, of course, Smart returned from an injury, and he was a significant factor off the bench. Boston's defense went to a completely different level with him on the floor, and his energy levels helped the Celtics establish a big lead in the first half. The Bucks, this was a nightmare situation for the Bucks. They were on the road, they were down by double digits. All the momentum was with Boston, and on top of all that, Giannis was unable to control the offense, and he was unable to get into a groove himself. To Milwaukee's credit, though, they did make a late push and to get themselves back into the game. It kind of reminded me of game four, but it was Boston trying to hold on instead of Milwaukee. But in the end, Marcus Smart's energy and intensity proved to be the difference, and honestly, if he had anything close to a reliable jump shot, he'd be an all-star. And you might be thinking, what drugs are you on here? But you look at the way that he plays, and the only thing holding him back on the offensive end is the inability to consistently knock down a jumper. Teams will go underneath screens, they will dare him to shoot. A lot of times he does shoot, that's why his percentages are down. He just can't make it, but they're good shots, and that's why you can live with it. And of course, as I said before, he plays on both ends of the court with intelligence and intensity. And going forward, he's the veteran. Obviously, Kyrie Irving's not available, but he's the veteran they need to complement Brown, Tatum, and Rozier, because he sets the tempo. He makes sure that they bring it every single game. And on top of that, he can swing a game, as we just saw in Game 5. Now, the game was up for grabs early on between Boston and Milwaukee. It's not like Milwaukee jumped out to a 15, 20-point lead or whatever. But when he came in with that energy, Milwaukee, they could have been a little bit unprepared for that. But he really did change the tempo of that game. Now, if I'm Milwaukee, I would give strong consideration to put Giannis on the block a little bit more. Because one, he has a decent back-to-the-basket game, plus he can also face up. But he's starting a little bit too far out for my liking, and what that is doing is, even with his incredible long strides, because of, he's just a freak athlete, he's got real long legs, but even with those long strides, because he's starting from around the three-point line, it gives the defense enough time to react and collapse, because it takes about two or three strides for him to get to a position where he can score. Now, you get him on the block, and then he's only really one dribble away from getting to the rim. And that will put the pressure on Boston to make a decision. Do they double him before he even puts the ball on the floor? And he's a good enough passer that if he's not dribbling, if he's got the ball in a triple threat, and the double is coming, he should be able to pick apart that defense. He should be able to find the open man. He's panicking a little bit when he's putting the ball on the floor and he has to dribble two or three times, and the Celtics defense is able to swarm him, and they're coming from different angles and different spots on the court, and it's unpredictable. But you get it on the block, slow it down a little bit, it's easier to make those decisions. But beyond that, don't expect a whole lot of changes from either team. We're now into Game 6, and we're probably going to get a Game 7 out of this series. So we've probably seen them, both teams, really play their hands. It's now up to the talent who can execute down the stretch, and it's been incredibly close. So there's going to be a wild ride the next two games. Boston was very close to winning Game 4, and we've seen the Bucks in a couple of games, Game 1 and Game 5 that we just saw, with a chance of actually winning in Boston. So this series could go either way, but you've got to like Boston's chances just because they've got two opportunities to win. And I do want to talk, talk about the potential Philly-Boston matchup in the second round, but this series is very much alive. So I will hold off that for now, but believe me, I am jumping at the bit to talk about that series. But instead, we're going to talk about Philly and Miami Game 5. And this was always going to be an interesting contest because how would Miami respond after dropping both games 3 and 4 on their home court? Likewise, how would Philly be able to handle a closeout situation at home? It's a lot of pressure for them as expectations are high and Miami came in with very little pressure from outside of themselves. The first half was a defensive grind, and Miami seemed to be imposing their will as they went into the halftime tied. They would have been ecstatic that they were tied at halftime, because that, and it was only 46 points all at halftime. They were right there, and that's exactly the situation you want to find yourself in up against a young team and an experienced team, although they are embracing the and handling the pressure very well of the playoffs, but you want to apply as much pressure as possible. So they're not in a situation where they can just steamroll over the top of you. Which is exactly what we started to see develop in the second half. And Philly started to break free and establish a double-digit lead. It looked as if the 76ers were on the verge of blowing this game right open. Miami did do a good job of just grinding away, and they found themselves right back in the game midway through the fourth quarter. Honestly, though, Philly seemed to be on the back foot as Miami made their run. And the Heat had multiple opportunities to cut further into the lead, but they just didn't go down. Open threes and things of that nature, offensive rebounds and kicking out the threes, so second chance opportunities. So if you're looking for areas for Philadelphia to improve as they progress, it wasn't the fact that they met the challenge head on. They just dodged bullets. And if Philly was playing a more talented team like Boston or even Milwaukee, they might not be so lucky in those situations. But at the end of the day, they survived, and this is the first series win for Philly since 2012. But let's put that into a little bit of perspective. That series they won in 2012, they were the number 8 seed, they barely made the playoffs, that was during the lockout year. So they were the 8 seed, they went up against the number 1 seeded Chicago Bulls, and that's when Derrick Rose blew out his knee the very first time. I can't remember if it was game 1 or game 2, I believe it was game 1. And Philly would end up winning that series of 6. Obviously, they lost game 1 because it was at the end of game 1 when Derrick Rose was injured. And it was a surprise that the series went to 6 after Derrick Rose, because that Chicago Bulls team was so reliant on Derrick Rose offensively. I believe Lowell Dang was their second leading scorer, but he wasn't even really their second option. Derrick Rose was maybe the third, and fourth option. And what I mean by that is you just put him in different areas of the court, allowing him to operate. So obviously him, ISO, is maybe their number one option. Him in a high screen is the second option. Him facing up from different elbows or foul line extended is a different option, and him getting to the front of the rim is probably their fourth option. And then after that, you go to Lowell Dang. So when you lose your first four options on offense, at least in the half court, you can tell why, you can see why Philly was able to take advantage of that and win that series. And then, of course, they were bounced by the 2012 Boston Celtics in the second round, but that Celtics team was so old. Rondo was in his prime, but Pierce was over the hill. That was Ray Allen's last year. Kevin Garnett was a shell of himself. Jeff Green had some good moments for them, actually, and we're seeing him now in Cleveland do likewise in Game 4, at least. So that was Philly's last playoff win, but once again, asterisk to it, because Derrick Rose got injured. It wasn't a genuine victory. For the last genuine, legitimate victory that they had in the playoffs, you have to go back to 2003, and they beat, and the Allen Iverson-led Philadelphia 76ers took out, get this, they beat the Baron Davis-led New Orleans Hornets. I will say that again, Baron Davis-led New Orleans Hornets. A lot of people forget that Baron Davis was actually on that Hornets team. That's how far back you've got to go. And to also keep it in perspective, I'm going to be talking about Dwayne Wade in a bit, but and the wonderful career he had. Dwayne Wade wasn't even in the NBA then. That's how long ago this was, and it feels like an absolute eternity. LeBron wasn't in the NBA. Carmelo wasn't in the NBA. These guys that are now the old heads of the NBA, they weren't even in the league. That was the last time that Philly really won a playoff series. And it's also a big reason why what we're seeing now in Philly is so special. For a franchise as important as the Philadelphia 76ers, you think of the iconic players from Wilt Chamberlain to Dr. J to Allen Iverson and Charles Barkley to Moses Malone. And then for this franchise to be so dormant, really for 15 years, because I'm not going to count 2012 when they were able to beat the Chicago Bulls without Derrick Rose. And now they're looking like one of the most impressive teams in the first round outside New Orleans. Who has been more impressive in the first round than the Philadelphia 76ers? Remember, they, okay, 4-1, but they are 3-0 with Embiid. And two of those victories were on the road. So for them now, as I said, to be one of the top teams in the league at this time of the year, that's special, man. The only way that this could be cooler is if, as I said before, if Boston is able to get through Milwaukee and these two can meet in the next round and the one of the great rivalries. Remember Bill Russell, Wilt Chamberlain, to Dr. J versus Larry Bird, to Paul Pierce versus Allen Iverson. Some great playoff duels. It would be fantastic. It would be, which was the NBA slogan back then, but it would be unbelievable if these guys met in the second round, especially as both of them are coming up. This isn't a case of 2012 where you got an 8-seed versus a team of old veterans that really don't have a whole lot left in the tank. Both of these teams are emerging, not just for in the future, but right now they are emerging and challenging for supremacy in the Eastern Conference right now. It's amazing. I'm so excited for it. But as I said before, it hasn't happened yet. And don't be surprised if Milwaukee wins Game 6 and they also win Game 7. Boston is by no stretch of the imagination, are they out of the woods yet in that series? So let's not get ahead of ourselves. As much as I want to, let's just not. And of course, we can't look ahead when we've got the Spurs versus Warriors. Look, another gutsy game by the Spurs. And the Warriors, they looked incredibly vulnerable against a severely undermanned Spurs team. And I know what you're thinking. Well, hold on a second. The Warriors, they didn't have Steph Curry. Well, yes, they still had 3 All-Stars. And the Spurs, they don't have Kawhi Leonard. And I will say this much before I get into the game, because I don't want to get bogged down in this. But if you put Kawhi Leonard on this on the Spurs team and you bring back a healthy Steph Curry, the Spurs have a much better chance of competing consistently against this Warriors team. Anyway, back to the game. And San Antonio was limited to 38 first-half points, and Aldridge was held to only 5. That changed in the second half as he dropped 25 points, and along with Ginobili, led a remarkable comeback. And that's why I was talking about it being a gutsy performance. Manu was actually playing point alongside Patty Mills. And you got to think that if they had gotten anything from Murray or Danny Green, we would be preparing for a Game 6. Instead, the Spurs are going home, and Golden State are advancing to take on a Pelicans team who appear poised to shock the world. And we'll have a thorough preview of that series in due time. But what I want to address is the possibility that Manu Ginobili, along with Dwayne Wade, this is why I didn't talk about it in the previous recap, that they've played their final games. And together, I mean, they've won 7 rings, 4 for Ginobili, 3 for Wade. And even though that they're assuming that they will indeed retire, will have exited in the first round, they've shown that they can produce in big games and moments. Just not as much as they could in their prime, but they can still, you know, they can still have a quarter or an impact like Dwayne Wade had at Game 2 of the series against Philly. From a historical standpoint, Wade, in my opinion, 4th greatest 2-guard of all time, behind only MJ, Kobe, and the logo Jerry West. Manu Ginobili is in my list of 50 greatest players of the 3-point era. When you look at his impact he had internationally too, when Team USA lost in 2004, it was Argentina led by Ginobili that won the gold medal. So that's significant. So when you look at how good Team USA slash Dream Team has been, they have won the gold medal at every single Olympics with the exception of one. And Manu Ginobili he left with the gold medal around his neck. It's unbelievable. And that to me is almost as significant to his career. In some ways, it probably is more significant in his career than all the championships he's won. As for how good he was, look, what I like to judge players on is not their stats, it's how well they fit to a team. And Manu Ginobili, if you had put him on any other team, we're talking about an MVP candidate much throughout his prime. Instead, he came off the bench throughout his prime, and he made that Spurs team just so much more lethal. They were allowed to bring in guys like Bruce Bowen to play the three position, along with getting virtually nothing out of the center position because Duncan was playing the four. And you, because what you could do is you bring Manu in and he's going to give you 20 points. He makes up for that lack of offensive production in those areas in that starting lineup. And in his prime in 2005, he should have been finals MVP in 2005. Tim Duncan won the award, but it should have been Manu. And anyone that watches that series knows that Manu was the only one, really, apart from Robert Horry in Game 5. One hell of a game, by the way, up against the Pistons. He was the only one that really stood up to Ben Wallace and Rasheed Wallace and Richard Hamilton and Tayshaun Prince and Chauncey Billups. All the other Spurs seemed to freeze in that moment. Because remember, the Spurs were up 2-0, and then the Pistons just went crazy. They blew out the Spurs. I haven't seen the Spurs get blown out that badly up until that point in a playoff series. Actually, I take that back. The 2001 Lakers handled them pretty good as well, but Manu wasn't on that team. And it was Manu who really stood up in that series and just didn't seem intimidated. It was kind of like Charles Oakley didn't seem intimidated by the bad boy Pistons. Manu Ginobili didn't seem to be intimidated by this version of the Pistons. And I've got a lot of respect for him for that. You know, to bottle up his game and then to produce in the playoffs in the biggest moments when your team needs it, that really says it all when it comes to judging a player. And Dwayne Wade's very similar when you think about it, because he was the man. I mean, in 2006, you could make an argument for him, even though Kobe was incredible in scoring 35 a game for the Lakers, getting a team with Kwame Brown and Chris Mim and Smush Parker and Luke Walton all starting and playing big minutes for him. Getting that team to the playoffs is no mean feat, right? But Dwayne Wade in the 2006 finals, and I know that people want to throw an asterisk on this because of the officiating, and some of their criticisms are absolutely legitimate. I don't want to get caught up into talking about the 2006 finals in this episode, because that's a topic for a show in of itself, and I may just do that, talking about the 2006 finals and whether we should acknowledge it with an asterisk and apply context every time it comes up, or do we, you know, look over it and say, well, Dwayne Wade was still incredible in that series, because any way you look at it, he was spectacular, whether you want to throw context on it or not. Regardless, Dwayne Wade, you could make an argument in 2006, I'll get to this point eventually, he was the best player in basketball. You can make that argument. And for him in 2009, you could say he was even better because he was dominant in 2009. I thought he was the regular season MVP ahead of LeBron in 2009. He should have been. If I had a vote, I would have voted for him. So there were a couple of instances where he was essentially the best player in basketball. And then he put his egos aside to fit in alongside LeBron. And his game went terrible playing alongside LeBron because he's not an outside shooter. You know, what they did well was their passing was so well that you could get good cuts for either guy and they were able to find them for that. But LeBron's game, and not much has changed, but LeBron's game is finding shooters or getting to the front of the rim and finishing himself. Now his offensive game's evolved a little bit now and he's got a much more reliable jump shot and post game. But back then, that was really, and that shows how good he was at those two things because he was able to win championships with it, but he never made Dwayne Wade better, and Dwayne Wade had to lower his role and basically hand over the reins of the offense and the team and the responsibility and the leadership responsibilities to LeBron in order for him to be a better player and make the team a better player. So both him and Manu Ginobili are very similar in that regard. Where the differences lie right now is the state of the franchises that they will leave Miami and San Antonio if they are to both retire. And Miami is in a much better spot right now than what San Antonio is. Because if Manu leaves, you've got to assume that Parker's out as well. Parker played horribly this season and this series. Who knows what's going to happen with Kawhi Leonard? My money is on him. He's already played his final game for the Spurs. So what they can get back for him, I don't think they're going to get a whole lot of assets. I don't think they're looking for a whole lot of assets that can help them immediately. They've got to rebuild. That brings into questions whether Popovich will want to return. Does he want to rebuild? There's no guarantees, or realistic guarantees or expectations that it will be a short rebuild. Very few teams are able to go from a dynasty to reloading that quickly. Even teams like the Lakers, who always seem to be able to rebuild rather quickly. I mean, they were able to do it relatively quickly from 2002 to 2009 when they kept Kobe all that time. But that's still 7 years, and they have one of the greatest players of all time to rebuild around. And as much as I like him and how hard he's played this season and this series, LaMarcus Aldridge is not Kobe Bryant. And even if it takes them 7 years, which is almost a best-case scenario for them, if it takes 7 years, LaMarcus Aldridge is going to be approaching 40 by the time they get back into championship contention. They're going to be looking for pieces to build for the future. And there's a very good chance that Greg Popovich, we've seen the last of Greg Popovich as a head coach of the San Antonio Spurs as well. And if that's the case, obviously Kawhi Leonard has a new location. But what do they do with Aldridge then? What good is it having one all-star player like Aldridge with a team that really can't even compete for the playoffs? They're probably going to look to trade him. And just to connect this to a couple of podcast episodes ago that I had where I was talking about what does Portland do, is it possible that we see him traded back to Portland? I mean, I wouldn't put my money on it, but surely they'd have to be somewhat interested because he would be a perfect fit to go back to play alongside Damian Lillard. Obviously, he's not the number one option, but you put him in that role where he would be absolutely perfect with his jump shot and his post moves and his passing ability and his ability to rebound and play undersized at the center position. He would be fantastic there. I would love it. I would love it to see him go back to Portland. That's his NBA home. That's where he belongs. The same way Dwayne Wade belongs in Miami and Manu Ginobili will always belong in San Antonio. In my opinion, LaMarcus Aldridge belongs in Portland. And I think really that's why I'm so at peace with Wade and Manu potentially walking away, is they're walking away for their teams, for the franchises, the teams that they're connected with. It's not Patrick Ewing retiring with the Orlando Magic. It's not Karl Malone retiring with the Los Angeles Lakers. It's not Paul Pierce retiring with the Los Angeles Clippers. These players are synonymous with their franchises. Dwayne Wade is synonymous with the Miami Heat, and Manu is synonymous with the San Antonio Spurs, at least in the NBA level. He's also synonymous with Argentinian basketball, obviously, as well. And if they do walk away, they are sure, both of them are surefire first ballot Hall of Famers, and their careers will be absolutely celebrated. And they rightly so. These were some real terrific eras in the NBA. Now let's look ahead to tomorrow's games. We have four series tied at 2-2, so we have four pivotal game fives. Amazing, isn't it? I've got Raptors beating the Wizards, Cavs beating the Pacers, the Rockets eliminate the Timberwolves, so we've got the home team winning in all of them so far. And then, of course, we have the Thunder versus the Jazz. Now, I messed up before. I said that we have all four games are 2-2. No, the Jazz are up 3-1. This is an elimination game. And you would think that the other series I would be paying a lot more close attention to, because you would think 2-2 series are on a knife's edge. But to me, there is so much more in this series than just, and in this game five coming up, than a single elimination game, which is, you know, is huge in of itself. So when you think about it, there's actually more on the line than the fact that the Thunder could go home. So I want to talk about this a little bit more before I let you go. And I think Westbrook responds and delivers in, quite honestly, the biggest game of his career since game six of the 2016 conference finals. Now that feels like an eternity ago, but it hasn't even been 2 years, but you just think about how the NBA has changed since then. And wow, one thing Oklahoma has to do, and I was thinking about this, is they have to have more activity off the ball. And what you'll see a lot of the times is that they'll run a screen or they'll get Paul George or Westbrook will begin to attack with the ball and they'll either get to their mid-range or they'll get to wherever they want to go. But there's far too many players just standing still. And that allows the Utah defense to really zone up and pay attention to the ball handler without any genuine concern for the guy they're actually guarding. The players away from the ball for Oklahoma, they have to force their defenders to react to them. And hopefully that can get the Jazz defenders from an Oklahoma standpoint, hopefully you can get the Jazz defenders into areas where they don't want to be in, and maybe that will open up things for Westbrook, because Westbrook has to lead them with intensity and execution. And honestly, it's going to be fascinating to watch how this Game 5 plays out. If Westbrook goes down, and if he plays terribly, oh man, as I said in the previous podcast, if his legacy will be forever tarnished. If he gets outplayed again by a rookie or outplayed again by Ricky Rubio and they lose in five games to a team that is nowhere near them in terms of individual talent, it doesn't matter what he does the rest of his career, he'll always have that tarnish. The same way LeBron will always have the 2011 finals tarnished against his legacy. Anyway, guys, thanks so much for listening. Episode 50... Can you believe that? Episode 50 will be coming up tomorrow. We have, as I said, four games. So I won't be able to get to the questions. There are a lot of questions backlogging up. I know. I'm sorry. But after tomorrow, there is, I believe, only one game scheduled. So we'll be able to handle quite a lot of your questions in that slot. But thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for your support. We are now, if you can believe this, we are now the number 2 ranked podcast on iTunes under sports and recreation in the United States. I'm not sure what it's like in Australia or wherever, but number 2, we are ahead of guys from Fox and ESPN and whoever. We are only behind Bill Simmons, and I don't think we'll ever catch him because he has such a legion of followers. But number 2, can you believe that? And we're not even up to number 50 in terms of episodes. So who knows where we're going to be when we get to our 100th episode. But thank you so much for listening. Thank you for sending the questions. Thank you for sharing it with your friends. I appreciate your support. And I hope you enjoy the podcast. And I hope you enjoy the games tomorrow. Thanks so much, guys.